I saw that idea of using the Ayatollah Khomeini's money to support the Nicaraguan freedom fighters as a good one. I still do. I don't think it was wrong. I think it was a neat idea.
And you know what? I think it's a neat idea to share the story of the Iran-Contra scandal with you. I'm Carrie Thompson, and 25 years ago, the magic that was Iran-Contra first became known to the American public. We'll trace the scandal from its origins to the moment the story broke in November 86. And we'll hear from a neat gal in her own right, comedian Carol Burnett.
I get letters where people do say I remind them of their mother, their sister, their daughter, their cousin, their aunt.
A profile of Aunt Carol. And on this episode of Dancing with the Stars, we'll have a remembrance of the tall, dark, and handsome film icon, Cary Grant.
I hope I haven't disturbed you.
Is there anything I can do for you?
Yes, there is, but first I'd better introduce myself.
That's not necessary. I know who you are.
The unforgettable Cary Grant. But first,
it's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Here's a potpourri of easy answers to easy questions.
Now, Dr. Science and his assistant, Rodney, have discovered movable type, and with it they have published their new book. It's called the official Dr. Science Big Book of Science. It's full of questions from listeners.
We no longer have to make up the questions. After we primed the pump, Noah, the general public took over.
Oh, really? And the questions, the level of questions, are as good or not as good as the ones you made up before?
Well, of course they're not as good as the ones we made up.
That's right. But the private sector does have something to recommend it.
And there's a lot of ignorance out there.
Yeah. Okay, good. One question that I loved, and I'll get right to it. How do boneless chickens procreate?
Well, first of all, boneless chickens are incapable of love as we know it. Chickens with bones aren't worth much in the love department either. In fact, they're as close to a vegetable as a bird can get. The scientific name for chicken is Aerodynamica sticklums, or fast turnip. So basically what happens is the boneless chicken flops around in the dirt with another boneless chicken. For scientists to know more about this, we'd actually have to observe boneless chickens mating. Well, this scientist has better things to do.
Ronnie, how can you sit there and just let him go on this way?
Well, I only help Dr. Science out of mental jams, and he doesn't seem to be having any right now.
Oh, he's in pretty good shape.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Where does electricity go when you turn off the light? This is like when you're a kid and you try to turn off the light and jump under the covers as quickly as possible.
Rodney, I'm having a mental jam. Can you help me?
Well, it depends on where. Electricity sometimes just usually goes to a bar, where it hangs out with the electrons go to their bar and the protons go to their bar.
Okay. Why do fluorescent lights hum?
They don't know the words.
And about ballpoint pens at the bank, you raised several questions about why don't they work, those pens that are on the chains on the tables there?
Well, you see, the ballpoint pens being at a bank are an example of a federal pen. That's a creature that's been in prison for a long time. It's on a parole study right now, but it's had to be chained to the counter. Once you release them from this imprisonment, they're so happy to be someplace else that they leak a fluid all over your pocket.
Hmm.
So you get what you pay for.
The other thing I was concerned about, it's not in the book, but I keep hearing in stories, reading in stories, hearing in stories about science, this term big science. It's a very serious term that they use, apparently.
Well, science is much bigger than anyone realizes at this point. Science
bigger than any one of us.
Even bigger than me. I mean, I did not receive my master's degree from any institution whatsoever. I gave myself a master's degree and declared myself an expert. And all Americans could do this too, Noah, if they only had the courage and the desire.
And the white coat.
Yeah. Well, you can buy one at the Goodwill for 50 cents.
Yeah. Now, you're not really a doctor. Doctor is something you call yourself.
Right. Doctor is my first name. My parents had the perspicacity to name me Dr. Science.
When most scientists say, call me doctor, they're being pompous. When Dr. Science says, call me doctor, he's just being friendly.
Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree.
In science.
Yes, and it didn't take a master's degree of any sorts to figure out that on November 3rd, 1986, things were going to get a little bit wiggy for folks in the Reagan administration.
Reports continue to circulate today that the U.S. has been involved in negotiations with Iran to get hostages released in exchange for arms. But President Reagan said there was no foundation to the story. NPR's Elizabeth Colton reports.
At first, President Reagan refused to comment on reporters' questions today about whether the U.S. and Iran have been engaged in secret deals. Then, during a bill signing ceremony at the White House, the president warned against speculation.
No comment, but could I suggest an appeal to all of you with regard to this, that the speculation, the commenting at all on a story that came out of the Middle East and that once has no foundation, that all of that is making it more difficult for us in our effort to get the other hostages free.
U.S. intelligence sources have said that President Reagan's former national security adviser, Robert McFarlane, has been the leading American envoy in the talks with Iran. McFarlane himself today told a Cleveland audience that now was not the time to discuss the questions about possible negotiations. But McFarlane insisted the U.S. has stuck to its policy of not providing weapons to Iran as long as that country supports terrorism. I'm Elizabeth Colton in Washington.
Now, I bet if you're anything like me, no matter how you try to parse this whole Iran-Contra scandal thing out, it seems to lack a certain logic. And I've had 25 years to think about it, unlike the people you'll hear in this next story who were asked in December 86 to give their own accounts of what the Iran-Contra scandal was all about.
The Iranians, the Arabians, had stolen some hostages, right? And everybody wanted to get them back.
We sent someone to talk to the Iranians, who we don't like.
And apparently what came out of that is a secret arms deal.
There were some arms that were sold by the Pentagon.
Arms were sent into Iran. Israel acted as the middleman.
Israel sold them to some Canadians, is the story. The Canadians got ripped off. They didn't get their extra money.
We took the money and put it in the bank.
And supposedly out of that came the release of one of the major hostage people that I can't remember his name.
Meanwhile, in the White House, as he was selling arms to the Iranians, the White House was selling arms to the Iraqis. Every other day, I guess, they'd switch off.
Where did the guns and money go?
Guns and money go. Yeah, boy, I just about forgot there.
Maybe Iran paid us for the guns. Maybe we paid them for the hostages.
Who was getting the money? That's another story. I couldn't answer that one either.
Maybe we gave them the guns and the money. Maybe they gave us the guns. I'm not sure.
Who got the guns?
Iran, wasn't it? Iran got those guns.
And the money. This is where the plot thickens.
They decided that we didn't really need the money. They needed it in Central America more.
That money was then funneled into the Contras.
The Contras say they don't know anything about it. It's great. I wish I had that bank account.
So we gave it to the Central Americans, but they don't have the check yet.
And this was all done entirely surreptitiously.
It was a secret mission, but apparently somebody, I believe, got too greedy, wanted a little more power, and decided to spill the beans.
That's pretty much all I can say. And then there's a big scandal about it with Oliver North and Poindexter, and they're still trying to figure out whether Reagan knew about it.
His people may have had something to do with it, but I don't think he had anything to do with it at all. He's trying to be made a fall guy by the Democrats. Those are the guys that started Watergate and are trying to start another one.
Okay, so that doesn't make any sense either. So what we need here is someone smart to explain this thing. And that man is NPR's Neil Conan. Now, for those of you following along at home, you should know a couple things. The Iran-Contra story was leaked in November 86 by the Lebanese weekly Al-Shara that reported that Reagan's national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, had bought the freedom of the hostage, Lawrence Jenko, with a sale of arms to the government of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Here's Neil.
In Washington, the White House contemptuously dismissed the Al-Shara report, but the Iranian government partially confirmed the account. Over the next few days, more and more reports of clandestine arms shipments emerged.
Good evening. I know you've been reading, seeing, and hearing a lot of stories the past several days attributed to Danish sailors, unnamed observers at Italian ports and Spanish harbors, and especially unnamed government officials of my administration. Well, now you're going to hear the facts from a White House source, and you know my name.
President Reagan then outlined what he described as a secret diplomatic initiative to Iran. Overtures intended, he said, to renew relations with a strategically vital nation to eliminate terrorism and win Iran's help in the release of U.S. hostages. The president insisted that reports of an arms-for-hostages swap were utterly false, but he then confirmed that weapons were sent to Iran.
During the course of our secret discussions, I authorized the transfer of small amounts of defensive weapons and spare parts for defensive systems to Iran. My purpose was to convince Tehran that our negotiators were acting with my authority to send a signal that the United States was prepared to replace the animosity between us with a new relationship. These modest deliveries, taken together, could easily fit into a single cargo plane.
The revelation raised immediate questions about legality and hypocrisy. There was a ban on arms shipments to Iran dating back to the Iranian Revolution and the seizure of the U.S. Embassy. No negotiations with terrorists was a central tenet of the Reagan presidency. His administration sent envoys around the world to rally support for the arms boycott against Iran, which was by that time fighting a desperate war with Iraq. The president's speech did nothing to resolve the apparent contradictions. Then, on November 25th, Attorney General Ed Meese made a second dramatic disclosure.
Certain monies which were received in the transaction between representatives of Israel and representatives of Iran were taken and made available to the forces in Central America which are opposing the Sandinista government there.
Those forces, familiarly known as the Contras, had been trained, equipped, and financed by the U.S. as part of the Reagan administration's drive to overthrow leftist governments that were seen as proxies of the Soviet Union. The policy included covert aid for guerrilla forces in Afghanistan and Angola, but nowhere was it more controversial than in Central America. At several different points, Congress cut off U.S. funds for the Contras. Now it seemed profits from the secret Iran arms sales had been diverted to the Contras in defiance of the law. Attorney General Meese said the president knew nothing about it.
The only persons in the United States government that knew precisely about this, the only person, was Lieutenant Colonel North. Admiral Poindexter did know that something of this nature was occurring, but he did not look into it further.
Oliver North, a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, was on the staff of the National Security Advisor, Vice Admiral John Poindexter. But few believed that this entire operation was limited to two White House officials. Less than 15 years after Watergate, it looked as if another administration was about to come unraveled amid investigations by a special prosecutor and Congress.
Here's the chairman of the committee.
And the Senate Select Committee on Secret Military Assistance to Iran and the Nicaraguan Opposition will come to order. Ladies and gentlemen, these hearings this morning and for the days to follow.
Various panels heard weeks of testimony through much of the summer of 1987. Thousands of documents were published, and there was testimony that many others had been destroyed. The picture that emerged was of an administration profoundly mistrustful of Congress. When Congress cut off support for the Contras in 1984 in a measure called the Boland Amendment, the White House decided to evade that law by funneling aid through the National Security Council. Oliver North established a network of private and public agents, all in secret, without any review by Congress. As various aspects of North's operations came to light, government officials, including North, could not answer Congress's questions truthfully without exposing the operation, so they lied.
I will tell you right now, counsel, and all the members here gathered, that I misled the Congress.
At that meeting.
At that meeting.
Face to face.
Face to face.
You made false statements to them about your activities in support of the Contras.
I did. And I did so with the purpose of hopefully avoiding the very kind of thing that we have before us now, and avoiding a shutoff of help for the Nicaraguan resistance, and avoiding an elimination of the resistance facilities in three Central American countries.
When Israeli contacts suggested in the spring of 1985 that some elements in Iran were interested in relations with the U.S., the administration again decided that the best way to keep such sensitive matters secret was to use the NSC and Oliver North. North overcharged the Iranians for the weapons, and he used the profits to put the hyphen in Iran-Contra.
I saw that idea of using the Ayatollah Khomeini's money to support the Nicaraguan freedom fighters as a good one. I still do. I don't think it was wrong. I think it was a neat idea. And I came back and I advocated that, and we did it.
The Contras received less than $4 million of diverted money. The rest was to be used to establish a self-financing operation to carry out covert actions in support of U.S. policy without authorization from Congress. But North's operation did not act entirely alone. The CIA assisted in the shipment of Hawk anti-aircraft missiles to Iran in November of 1985. A month later, Secretary of State George Shultz and Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger warned the president that that shipment was ill-advised and illegal. According to Weinberger's diary, quote, "The president said he could answer charges of illegality, but couldn't answer the charge that big, strong President Reagan passed up a chance to free the hostages." In December 1985, President Reagan signed a document called a finding to try to legalize the Hawk shipment retroactively. John Poindexter kept it in his safe in the White House until news of the arms shipments broke a year later.
The president was being beaten about the head and shoulders that this was, the whole Iranian project was just an arms for hostage deal. Well, this finding, unfortunately, gave that same impression. And I, frankly, didn't see any need for it at the time. I thought it was politically embarrassing. And so I decided to tear it up. And I tore it up, put it in the burn basket behind my desk.
Over the course of the long investigation, several senior administration officials were forced to leave office. A few negotiated plea bargains. A few others were tried and convicted. The convictions of Oliver North and John Poindexter were overturned on appeal. The presidency of Ronald Reagan was diminished but not destroyed. Under pressure from the United States, the Sandinistas held elections in Nicaragua in 1990 and lost, bringing the Contra War to an end. Some hostages were released following arms transfers to Iran, but others were kidnapped in their place. Associated Press correspondent Terry Anderson, the longest held and the last to be released, came home in December of 1991. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Happy days are here again. The time is right.
By the way, former hostage Terry Anderson ran in 2004 on the Democratic ticket to represent the 20th District in the Ohio Senate and lost to Republican Joy Padgett.
Boys will be boys, better let them have their toys. Girls will be girls, cute ponytails and curls.
So if you feel like you may be hallucinating, you may have an inkling of what it was like to hang around New York City in the go-go 80s. Here's a story from writer Robert Stone about the proliferation of crack cocaine on New York streets.
In the morning, driving into Manhattan, the traffic had seemed particularly demonic. I'd had a peculiar exchange with a bridge toll taker who seemed to have one half of a joke I was expected to have the other half of. I didn't. Walking on 14th Street, I passed a man in an imitation leopard skin hat who was crying as though his heart would break. At 4th Avenue, I was offered the Elleville. Elleville relieves the depression attendant on the deprivation of re-refined cocaine, crack, which is what the men cracking the imaginary whips were selling. Moreover, I'd been reading the papers. I began to think that I was seeing stoned cops, stoned grocery shoppers, and stoned boomers. I felt as though I were about to confront the primary process of hundreds of thousands of unsound minds. What I was seeing in my vision of New York as super-stoned super-city was cocaine in its role of success drug.
Robert Stone, writing in Harper's Magazine, about a day he spent walking through Manhattan, a day of surreal or hyper-real encounters, a day in which he came to feel that the rhythms of the city had dramatically changed under the influence of cocaine.
When you walked through the Garment District just a few years ago, you could smell marijuana all day long. You still see people huddled in groups smoking, but you don't smell marijuana anymore. When people smoke crack, they take on a certain appearance. I mean, they seem in the grip of emotion. Frequently, their faces are flushed, their eyes are moist. They look as though they're in some kind of emotional transport.
You're describing seeing men cracking imaginary whips, crack. They're trying to sell you crack. That's what that means, I guess.
So I've been told.
And Elleville. Elleville is an antidepressant, and it indeed was a discouraging thing to read about Elleville being as important on the drug market as the drug that sends you up.
Well, it's an inevitable result, I guess.
When you write about this, about this new description of Manhattan. Are you overstating the case? Are you just writing about those very few examples that you see on the streets? Or did you really have this experience of going through the streets and feeling surrounded by people doing this drug?
Once you see it and you start looking at it, it's really hard not to keep seeing it. Certainly, that was my experience. I saw it once, and then I couldn't stop seeing it. And I don't think it was me.
And you're right that all over America at this moment, pleasurable surges of self-esteem are fading. All over America, people are discovering that the principal thing one does with cocaine is run out of it.
I think that's something that eventually everybody who ever uses cocaine discovers.
Have you changed your mind about this or any other drug over the past couple of years or with the advent of crack?
I don't know if I've changed my mind. I think that I never saw drugs as a positive thing. They're dangerous. They're powerful. They were always that. Cocaine has certain properties that are particularly invidious. Its tendency to make people paranoid, its association with violence, the dramatic absence of, the dramatic contrast, rather, between having some and not having some. It makes it a very primal and rather frightening kind of drug.
Along comes Sally with her nose all tall. The doctor says she can't sniff no more. He says the cocaine's for horses, it's not for men. He tells me gonna kill me, but he don't say when. I'm simply wild about my good cocaine.
Now's a good time for a little comic relief. Here's Bob Edwards with a profile of actress Carol Burnett.
Comedian Carol Burnett grew up in an era that wasn't very funny. She was born in San Antonio, Texas, and moved with her family to Hollywood during the Depression. There, she lived for 15 years in a room that contained a couch, a Murphy bed, and Nanny, Burnett's grandmother. Carol Burnett's parents separated when she was very young, and both died as alcoholics. In her recently released memoir, entitled One More Time, Carol Burnett talks about those early years.
It wasn't what one would call a terribly painful childhood. And sometimes some of the stories now that are coming out, they cull that from the book, and I get a little uptight about that because it sounds like poor, pitiful Pearl. But it is not a story where I'm complaining about how I was raised. That's the way it was. There was a lot of love, and there was a lot of sorrow and tears, but mostly there was great fun.
Carol Burnett made it fun. She used to entertain herself and the neighborhood by creating her own radio show. There wasn't much money in the family, but Burnett got some unexpected breaks after she decided to go to college. She applied to UCLA, but had no idea where she'd get the money for tuition. One day she opened her mailbox, and there it was, left by an anonymous donor. As a junior at UCLA, Burnett got lucky again. A man she calls Mr. C gave her $1,000 so she could go to New York.
I'd never seen that many zeros in my life. And I took it and I ran with it and came here. That was in 1954. And with the stipulation, he lent me the money with the stipulation that it'd be paid back in 5 years, no interest. It wasn't a gift, it was a loan. And that I never reveal his name, for obvious reasons, and three, that if I do become successful in my chosen field, that I would help others out. And that's the truth. That's how it happened.
In New York, Burnett organized a musical review that led to work in summer stock and television. But Carol Burnett's big break came when she had a hit with the novelty song, I Made a Fool of Myself, over John Foster Dulles. Because of that success, Burnett landed the role of Princess Winfred, the woebegone in the off-Broadway production of the musical Once Upon a Mattress. She took the show onto Broadway for a one-year run.
Where'er I roam, my heart grows dank and cold. My face grows gray when shadows fall and I hear. Winifred, who do you think you are, girl of the swamp? You've gone too far.
The Carol Burnett Show premiered on CBS during the 1966-67 TV season. 11 years later, it left the air as the longest-running musical comedy variety show in television history. In this scene with Tim Conway from that show, Burnett portrays an elderly woman whose husband gives her an affectionate squeeze.
That remind you of anything?
Joan Amos.
Because I'm so glamorous?
No, because you'd need 10 other men to help you score.
These days, variety shows are out of fashion, but not for Carol Burnett.
I always loved it because it gave all of us a chance to not only play one character, but a lot of different characters each week, and also music and various guests, which I always loved having to see what the chemistry would be with a new guest or somebody who worked out, and to have them keep coming back. That was really fun.
You would do the bit of, you'd try to sing a torch song and get splashed with water or something. I know where that comes from now, having read it in the book.
Right, yeah, being too nervous about singing straight. The only time I can do that or halfway do it is if I'm in a character in a show. And if the character sings a straight song, then I can get into it that way. But just to stand up and sing, I'm not really a singer, and I don't want to pretend to be. But I'm not afraid with other people. Looking into somebody else's eyes gives me a lot of courage.
I've always been shy. I confess that I'm shy. Can't you guess that this confident air is a mask that I wear cause I'm shy?
Why do your fans love you so much? Why was there, it seemed to me, a special bit of endearment towards you than other folks on television?
Good grief. I feel close to a lot of people. One lady once came up to me and said, can you give me some advice for my daughter? And I said, yes, what? She said, well, she wants to be in show business, and everybody says she's exact just like you. This was quite a few years ago. She says, oh, she's another Carol Burnett. She's just like you. And I started to give her some advice, and she said, well, I thank you very much. And I told my daughter that if you can make it, Carol, anybody can. So maybe there is a common denominator of people identify. I don't know. I get letters where people do say I remind them of their mother, their sister, their daughter, their cousin, their aunt.
Well, things look great. Gonna have a whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's gone.
On November 15th, 1986, actor Cary Grant passed away at the age of 82. Here's an appreciation of Grant from reporter Steve Futterman.
Whenever anyone tells me that we have no royalty here in America, five words immediately come to my mind. Ladies and gentlemen, Cary Grant.
Jack Lemmon's introduction of Cary Grant at the 1985 Academy Awards may best sum up just how respected and admired Cary Grant was in Hollywood. He was born Archibald Leach in Bristol, England in January 1904, the son of a poor family. At the age of 13, he left home to join an acrobatic troupe. Eventually, in the 20s, he came to America, played the New York vaudeville circuit. That led to Hollywood and fame. He first gained significant notice in 1933, starring opposite Mae West, who in a memorable scene told him to come up and see me sometime. This exchange between Grant and West took place in the film I'm No Angel.
I hope I haven't disturbed you.
Not so far. Is there anything I can do for you?
Yes, there is, but first I'd better introduce myself.
That's not necessary. I know who you are. I've heard Keck speak of you.
Good. That simplifies matters. It's on Kirk's account. I'm here.
Do you mind if I get personal?
Go right ahead. I don't mind if you got familiar.
Cary Grant appeared in some of Hollywood's best films. There were the light comedies like His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. There were the Hitchcock thrillers, Notorious with Ingrid Bergman, To Catch a Thief with Grace Kelly, and North by Northwest with Eva Marie Saint. Finally, there were the classics like The Philadelphia Story. In this scene, Cary Grant appears alongside Katharine Hepburn.
Red, you could be the finest woman on this earth.
I'm contemptuous of something inside of you. You either can't help or make no attempt to. Your so-called strength, your prejudice against weakness, your blank intolerance.
Is that all?
That's the gist of it. Because you'll never be a first-class human being or a first-class woman until you've learned to have some regard for human frailty. It's a pity your own foot can't slip a little sometime. But your sense of inner divinity wouldn't allow that. This goddess must and shall remain intact.
Today here in Los Angeles was a time for many of Cary Grant's colleagues to look back. Actor Stuart Granger, a fellow Briton, called Cary Grant simply the best.
If you said to me, who was the greatest male star the movies have presented to the world, I'd have to say probably Cary Grant. I think Cary Grant epitomized everything that we chaps wanted to be and what the ladies wanted to have, you know, was Cary Grant, so debonair, and he had such style, he had class.
Cary Grant made his last film in 1966, Walk, Don't Run. To the end, though, he remained a private person. Rarely would he grant interviews or sign autographs, but to the end, he also remained one of Hollywood's most popular figures.
Gotta love that Cary Grant. Next month, it's Xmas, which means stories about our favorite guy with a white beard.
Christmas in jail. Christmas
Santa
in jail.
Fans will be relieved to hear today that one certain Santa Claus is recovering from a gunshot wound. James Stevenson, a volunteer Santa visiting the state penitentiary in Santa Fe yesterday, accidentally was shot in the leg when a .25-caliber automatic handgun discharged as it was being put away. The handgun belongs to Deputy Sheriff Dixon Womack. The weapon was being stored because guns aren't allowed in the prison.
Uplifting little holiday gems on your way from the NPR archives.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
They're singing down.
Special thanks this month go to our intrepid intern, Claire DeMura, and our friend and confidant, Michael Katzen. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.
Christmas in jail. Christmas in jail. Wore my shoes, I'll pay some bills.